So, hello and welcome to the EV Cafe Takeaway, a podcast focused on the zero emission future that we all hope for. Every week, I'm joined by a various member of the EV Cafe team, and this week, I've got Sam Clark. Welcome, Sam.
Ah, thank you. I'm very pleased to be here. It's not that often I get a chance to, so it's great.
I know, and it's great to have you. But more importantly than that, and yes, there is somebody more important than you, Sam. Always pulling faces now. We welcome every week innovators, pioneers, and collaborators to our chat room. And this week is no exception. We have the wonderful Andy Eastlake. Andy, welcome to you.
Good morning. Thank you very much indeed. It's great to be here, Paul. Good to see you, Sam. Great to see you along for the takeaway.
Well, Andy, we like to do a little bit of desktop research before we get to the meat of the conversation. And you seem to do a lot on Twitter. Over 1,300 tweets, it seems. But more importantly than that, you are the founder member of Zemo Partnership back in 2003. Wow, that's a long time ago. And do you know what? I saw a quote about you, and it says, Andy is a fantastic engineer and his enthusiasm for the profession is an inspiration. This was on your LinkedIn profile. So what we love is enthusiastic people. But Andy, what gives you that enthusiasm each day for engineering, which, you know, typically people don't think as particularly inspirational?
Well, absolutely right, Paul. I mean, be careful going around my social media, because, you know, sometimes on Twitter you do end up with some things that you don't want there as well. So, it's a good question. I guess I probably set out to be an engineer originally. I just loved working out how things work and how to make things better. And that's kind of what's driven me. So I didn't really set out to be sustainability and eco or anything like that. I was very much into, finding out how things work and understanding, you know, the tools that you could use to make them better in whatever way you define better. And I think I've mentioned previously that everybody defines better in different ways. And that's part of the challenge. And for me, part of the interest. I'm honoured to be here being interviewed by the electric van man, but I've got a couple of years on you, Paul, I think, and arguably I think I'd lay claim to being the original van man. My first car was actually a CF minibus. That was what I bought at the age of 17, and I am still, some of my college friends today still know me as Andy Van, because we used to differentiate the Andys in our college course by what car they drove. So I am still known as Andy Van to some people. So I guess I started out in commercial vehicles and started out wanting to understand more about how things worked and what you could do and that sort of stuff. And I've ended up here at Zemo, hopefully helping move that agenda forward. But it's been quite a long journey on the way.
Yeah, and Andy, it is one of the things that has always made me look to you often for information, for wisdom, for, you know, if I look to somebody that I want to trust in the commercial vehicle industry, particularly around this transition that we're going through, I definitely look to you, because I do know that you have an immense amount of knowledge that you've built up over the years. But how did it all start? How did that journey begin, you know, back at school, or was it family? How was it that you got that interest?
Well,
I wanted to buy a van at 17.
Yeah, absolutely. So the first thing I'll say, it's not an immense amount of knowledge. It's probably an immense amount of friends who've got lots of knowledge. I think that's really important. So as long as you know people who know answers, that's a really critical point.
It's not what you know, Andy. It's who you know.
It's definitely who you know, and whether you know them well enough. That's also the question.
So yes.
The person that sort of set me on this journey was my father. He was a physicist by trade. You know, quite academic. He did a PhD, or started a PhD, didn't complete it. And he was part of the sort of, you know, the pioneers of lasers and all that sort of stuff in the day. But he always classed himself as an engineer, because he saw that as what he actually did and what he was actually doing in terms of helping people, engineering solutions. And I guess that's what kind of set me on my journey. Probably the other key person that I would say took me to where I am now was my mother, for obvious reasons, but she was actually the physiotherapist at Vauxhall Motors in Luton. And I'm, you know, now they're in the Premiership. I'm proud to say I was born in Luton. You know, there's a time where you wouldn't have said that, but I was born at Luton and Dunstable Hospital. So that was kind of my background. And when I went through school and all that sort of stuff. And when I came out and was looking for university degrees, engineering was what I, you know, wanted to do. Because I had an affinity for mechanical stuff. I'd taken all my dad's motorbikes apart and failed to put them back together again, much to his annoyance and things like that. And then I looked for sponsorship. So, you know, one of the things, you know, back in my day, you did thick sandwich sponsorship, a year in industry and then 3-year degree and year out. And I had two offers of sponsorship. One of them was from Vauxhall Motors and the other one was from RSAF Enfield, the makers of small arms, you know, rifles and things. And I figured I wanted to move people rather than kill people. So, I went with Vauxhalls and therein started the journey. So I was sponsored by Vauxhalls back in the early 80s and did my degree and sort of, you know, years with them. And I guess one of the things that set me on my journey, I remember vividly one of the first projects I got involved in was actually looking at speedometer accuracy on, so this would have been Mark II Cavalier, I think, for those of you that remember that, you know, the sports hatch shape, that sort of stuff. Yeah. And I did a study with AC Spark up in Kirby, who used to do the speedos for Vauxhalls. And I found that you could actually make the speedos a lot more accurate than they were. And I sort of dug into, well, why didn't we do that? And from an engineering perspective, we could make speedometers to be within 1 or 2 miles an hour, but they were always calibrated to read quite a lot faster than the real speed that they legally have to be. And that was because there was this competition about, well, you know, my Astra GTE can go 120 or this sort of, you know. So the speedos were calibrated to be at the top end of the limit. And that was where it sort of, you know, there's always different ways of looking at these problems. And that's kind of what I like now is, you know, my perception as a purist engineer might be one thing, but the reasons for doing it a different way or approaching it in a different way might be perfectly valid or you know, different. And I think that really is what I like is getting lots and lots of perspectives and then trying to work out what the consensus and the right place to be is. And I think the EV community is a great one for that. There's different reasons for having an EV and making sense of those and making sense of those to the consumer is something that I think is really, really interesting in terms of understanding what motivates, what's the hot button that's going to make people make that difference and take that leap. So that's kind of where it started. And all the way through my career, I think I've tried to approach it in that way as sort of, you know, don't take one person's word for it. Ask lots of people, like I say, lots of friends and lots of perspectives, and then try and make sense of them all in your own mind to work out a way forward.
So, Andy, I've got a question for you based on what you've just said. So it's really interesting to hear some of your background, by the way. We've known each other a long time, but I didn't really know anything about you pre the low CVP days, as Zemo used to be back in the day. At what point was there a transition into sustainability and a focus on that particular area, rather than obviously in the traditional Vauxhall days and everything else when EVs weren't a thing, of course, in the 80s and 90s, but now, you know, it's so prevalent. Somewhere along that journey,
yeah,
your focus shifted into sustainability. So how did that happen?
Well, it did. I guess it was all about efficiency. So when I graduated, I ended up in the emissions laboratory at Millbrook. So that was owned by Vauxhalls at the time. So, you know, I cut my teeth on fuel economy and emissions measurement. So that principle of how can we make things work better and more efficiently, whether that's lower emissions or lower fuel consumption, was really sort of, and that ultimately takes you obviously through hybrids, plug, you know, range extenders and into EVs. And as you know, Sam, I'm still quite passionate about EV efficiency, even charger efficiency. You know, we need to make sure these things are looked at with the same rigor that we look at the car or the battery itself, for example. And actually, one of my first jobs, so very early on, we were just starting to measure particulates. One of my first jobs was actually measuring the particle emissions from the IBC MIDI. And Paul, you'll remember the vans, the IBC vans coming out of Luton plant at that stage and things. So particulates were just coming on stream. I got into that. And I think what drove me was actually learning how to measure things better. So particulates, great example, you know, these big lumps of stuff, how do you measure them? And then can you measure the size of them? Can you measure what they're made of? Or can you go and measure different emissions and NOx species? And so I actually spent a lot of time sort of realizing that unless you can measure it properly, you can't really do anything about it. So my, if you like, what drove me was that passion to measure things better and provide better answers to the people that could then do something about it and make a difference.
But I mean, Andy, what makes somebody think about the size of a particulate? I mean, what drove you to even care about that kind of thing? I mean, that's a really inquiring mind.
Well, it's actually so that again, it's the other perspective coming in. So why are we measuring emissions? And you know, those emissions, particulates, are from a health perspective. So what's the health impact of a particulate? A big lump, if we talk about particulates, they can be almost any size. A big lump isn't going to be that unhealthy unless it lands on your head and kills you, sort of thing, if it's the size of a brick. Really, really tiny ones can get, you know, ingested, breathed right in. They can actually pass through the walls of the lung into the bloodstream. So the size becomes important as to where it gets into you, and therefore what health effect it will have. And you know, this science, and I'm absolutely not a health expert in any way, but the fact that the health experts were saying, well, size of particle is important, and then the composition. So if it gets a certain distance into your lungs, what's that particle made of, and therefore what impact will it have on your health? So my piece of the jigsaw was, well, can I help them understand those things? How big the particles are, how many of them are coming out of a vehicle. So we started out, absolutely, I mean, particles are measured in mass. So you talk about the mass of particulates, 10 milligrams per kilometer, whatever it might be. But that doesn't tell the whole story, because 10 milligrams in one particle is very different than 10 milligrams in, you know, billions and billions of tiny ones. So you have to talk about number and mass. And again, that's one of my passions, is when we talk about particulates today, don't just talk about a 30% reduction or I've got this much, you know, in terms of particles. Tell me the mass, tell me the size, tell me the composition. Then we can start working out what we want to address. So that was, you know, that was an area where I that was probably in the early 90s. We were doing some of the really sort of seminal work in particle measurement. And that actually was driven by work with London Transport buses on the old route masters running along Oxford Street. They had a real problem with air quality in London. And we started doing this innovative particle measurement with London Transport buses, because they were, so what became TfL, obviously, it's LTB in the day, because they were one of the leading lights in trying to understand the impact of their vehicles. And they are today. They are, you know, London Transport do some really good, or Transport for London, sorry, do some really good work in this space. So that was where that took me into buses and heavy duty vehicles and all of that sort of thing.
So when did it all begin to? Because I mean, you know, it's fascinating to me that at some point somebody went, oh, hang on, we've got this real issue with air quality. When did that sort of come on the radar first? Because I mean, I know Zemo or low CVP kicked off around 2003, but where's the journey there?
Yeah, so I mean, air quality was identified back in the 70s. Was the first, so 7220, the EC regulation, was the first air quality regulations here in Europe, and that was sort of driven by the states, by California. So there was a lot of work going on air quality through the 70s, pre even my time in terms of measurement. You know, I was in short trousers then as well. So so when I joined in the sort of early 80s and things, we were just sort of measuring NOx and particulates. So we were moving up. You know, raising the ante. This was pre-catalyst days, of course. But what we were doing is suddenly coming into electronic fuel injection, which changed the game. And I guess that was one of the things, you know, I was brought up with carburettors and things like that. But electronic fuel injection and the ability of electrons to control stuff was just, you know, mind-blowing in terms of that interface between controlling a mechanical and a combustion system with electronic fuel injection things, and you know, electronic spark control thing. And that I mean, that's what really, you know, part of my passion about electrons is they're so fungible, they're really, really good, they're really rapid, you know, so actually you can do some amazing things with electrons that you just can't do with mechanical stuff. So as a mechanical engineer by trade, I've pushed one of my daughters into electronics, I'll be honest. Yeah, that's where the future is. So, but yeah, I mean, air quality was one of the big drivers through the whole of my early career. When low CVP started, it was, you know, it had a mandate on air quality as well as low carbon. So we really didn't start getting into carbon and fuel consumption measurement until quite late on. It was an air quality problem from vehicles. And I think it's fair to say we are getting to grips with that. You know, the air pollution from combustion engines. I know this is the EV cafe, but we do still have a lot of combustion engines and people are still buying more of them than they should at the moment. So we have to address that as much as possible as well. And whilst we transition to a zero tailpipe emission. But I think that's where you come into, you know, zero tailpipe is one thing from the EV. We as a community obviously know about the tyre and brake wear, and particulates from tyres and brakes are very, very complex and an awful lot of misinformation out there, I would say. But it is something we need to look at and we need to address as well.
Yeah, Andy, I was about to just add a quick point as well. And I think that, as you know, I ran a logistics company in London with fully electric for many years, and air quality wasn't really a thing even in 2009 when I started per se. It was sort of, well, it's a good thing to be electric, but, you know, that was about it. Obviously air quality was a factor, but it became more and more prevalent as the years went on. And it's not just about the vehicle's emissions, is it, anymore? It's about the dirt on the road. It's the tire wear, the brake wear, all those things are now becoming more important, you know, and measurable. So I guess it's shifted from, you know, electronics helping injectors on engines through to actually particulate matters in all walks of our life.
Yeah, I think it's been an evolution, Sam. So, you know, when I started out, the emissions we were worried about were hydrocarbons and CO. So we were worried about, you know, basically a lot of fuel just passing straight through the engine and through the exhaust. And I did a lot of work on fuels and, you know, a lot of the early work on the auto oil program, looking at different emissions and things like that. As we got to grips with that and we got, you know, much more efficient engines, you know, higher pressures, and NOx started coming to the fore, as diesels became more prevalent, particularly in light duty, obviously particulates. So we've actually gone through a series of cycles of, you know, focus on hydrocarbons and CO, then a focus on sort of NOx and particulates, then a focus on species of NOx, so NO, NO2, N2O, and then particulate size composition. And now, exactly as you say, we've kind of, you know, we've now got zero tailpipe emission vehicles. So what's happened is that the particulates from the tyres and brakes, they've always been there, but now they're a big portion of the problem.
Biggest emitter.
Because the problem is so much smaller than it was 20 years ago, 40 years ago when I started. So you're absolutely right. And there's a report just come out, just published yesterday, actually, on some of the early work on looking at how to measure tyre and brake wear. And boy, is it tricky. That's my summary. That's my executive summary of the report. Boy, is it tricky. And there's an awful lot of background stuff that you really have to worry about when you're measuring this. So, beware the dramatic percentage of tyre and brake wear that you might see in a headline, because there's always more to the story than that.
Yeah, thank you for the executive summary of the executive summary. That'll save me a long read. Paul, I think you want to delve into some more personal questions, I believe.
Well, yeah. I mean, Andy, it's incredible to sort of hear that kind of real insight that comes out from your years of work in this sector, and, you know, how you got to be that sort of focus, or have that focus on particulates and air quality and, you know, efficiency, right? Because I know that's really, really important to you. But then I look back at your first vehicle and your early name, Andy Van. the original Van Man, everybody. But why on earth did you buy a minibus? What drove you to do that?
That's a very good question, Paul. I'm not sure I absolutely know the answer. One of those, it seemed like a good idea at the time, sort of occasions. My earlier years, sort of, you know, the 16 through 20, I was very involved in the scouting movement, all the way from Cubs through Scouts, things like that. And then I joined the Venture Scouts in Harpenden. So my hometown is Harpenden, just south of Luton, as you know. And the Venture Scout unit in Harpenden was the biggest in Europe, I think, at the time, 200-odd members and things. So that became my whole social life outlook. And within that, you've got 200-odd 18-year-olds and things, and all wanting to go walking, hiking, doing all sorts of things. Having a minibus proved very, very useful with that environment. So I guess I bought it as part of that. I was chairman of that group. So I think one of the things that I've done is that, you know, I like to surround.
Andy, hang on. You were chairman of the Venture Scout group at 18 years old.
Something like that, yeah. I think, yes, that's right, yeah. I was treasurer of the year before.
Leadership was in your blood from really early on.
I was thinking
it?
That.
Maybe it was. I don't know. I don't think I've ever sort of craved it, but you end up emerging by talking to lots of people and by trying to make sense of lots of people and trying to articulate that. You end up leading them, and I think it's really important to lead people that you like and respect, and to work with people you like and respect as well. I think that's and if you're in that environment, great things can happen, I would say. So I was treasurer for a year, which, you know, this is we took 140 of us to Switzerland on a 2-week trip, and I had to handle all the finances for that, which was quite an interesting exercise. And we had 100 of us go down with gastroenteritis as well, but that was another story entirely. So I did this treasurer, and then I think I was told by my mother I wasn't allowed to be chairman when I was doing my A-levels. So the year after my A-levels, when I was working, doing my thick sandwich first year, I was chairman of that group, and I had my minibus, and at the time of my life, absolutely the time of my life. And that was what kind of, I think, sort of set me on this journey. And then I toddled off to university in my minibus, and was, you know, I was obviously friends with lots of people at university, not friends with the parking wardens at the Hall of Residence, it has to be said, but definitely friends with lots of people at university. And that, there I became Andy Van, for my sins, I guess.
So, I mean, the time of your life, you describe it as, who was your best friend through that time? And what's a really great memory that you have from that time that's perhaps shaped your future?
I met my wife at Ventures. That was, I met her before I married her. That was, you know, we didn't get married that time. I didn't just bump into my wife there and say, oh, what are you doing here? No. It was,
you met her before you married her, you just said.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
It's good to know.
So I met my wife at 16. We didn't get married for many, many years. You know, we had some wilderness years, I think we call them. So I guess, you know, I had a lot of friends in that environment. A lot of my family, you know, my brother was there as part of the Venture Scout unit as well. And a lot of that sort of interface. Best friend, it's difficult to pick one, I would say. I think going through that period, there were so many really, really inspiring people at so many different levels, both older leaders and younger people that were coming through, that it's impossible to pick one and say that was the person that sort of drove it. I think one of the things I found throughout my working career is that everybody you meet has a backstory that's really interesting. I remember when I was at Millbrook, one of the guys that worked for me for many, many years, he was a technician, sort of, if you like, one of the guys driving the tests and things, but he was an incredible artist. And I never found that out until sort of 3 or 4 years in, when we started doing some, we did some social events and things, and he and I were trying to sort of sell them, and he started doing illustrations for these social events. And it's just this incredible artist that you just would not have known if you just stuck to the day-to-day work and stuck in that little box. And I think that's a really important point, that everybody's got something incredible behind them that you don't know about. And it's sometimes very difficult to get to that unless you can get outside the work environment and just allow yourself the space to get to know the people rather than just the worker, if you put it that way.
So what is that thing for you, Andy?
Crikey. Oh, I don't know whether I've got anything very interesting behind me.
Of course you have.
I really don't know what I'd pick on, actually, now. I used to do quite a lot of cycling. Lapsed somewhat now, as you can tell from the figure. But lockdown brought some of that back. I like to make my own wine, and my wife likes to drink that, so that's always good. I really don't know what I would say is the backstory. I think I'm genuinely interested in the work that I do. So, you know, I will go and dig around these things and try and find out and read in the background and try and talk to people sort of offline. And that's probably one of the criticisms is now it's I find it more difficult to switch off from work than maybe I should. So it's, you know, it's really important to try and sort of, yeah, make that space, I think, sometimes to stop thinking about, you know, it might be a passion, but you do need to sometimes take a break from that and go and do something entirely separate. So that I do go out and cycle a little bit now just to get away from cars and efficiency and everything else. So,
do you ever think
that's very sage advice?
Do you ever think to go back to Venture Scouts or the whole Scout movement and involve yourself in that?
Actually, after some years later, I went back as a leader to my old Scout troop, and had a few years there, and then it was the distance, you know, where I was living, and the distance made it quite tricky to do. But I did. I was a Scout leader for quite a while. Really enjoyed that. I went and was governor of my girls' school, primary school, and ended up chair of governors as well. So you know, that's all those things that you end up sort of dropping into these. Probably because you don't step back when they ask for any volunteers. I guess that's the question. That's the that's the reason, rather than anything too rewarding. But so I've just sort of emerged into those situations. I stopped the governor role when I moved into London, when I took over at Zemo or Low CVP at the time, because it just wasn't compatible with the sort of commute and things like that. So finding time and finding these activities outside of your work life, I think, is really important. And that's, as I say, if it's a criticism of me now, it's that I haven't sort of found that time and established that other identity in a place outside. So, I'll have a think about that one.
Well, Andy, once you've worked that out, would you mind giving me a quick call and letting me know how to do it, please?
I'm sure we can do something together, Sam. We'll start.
The thing is, we talk shop, though, wouldn't we? That's
probably
the trouble.
Yeah.
that would defeat the entire point, wouldn't it?
It would, definitely.
So, yeah, I got a question for you, Andy. So it's really interesting to hear all the things that you've done and the places you've been, especially one thing's fascinating about doing these things, these podcasts, and even with the EV Cafe crew, understanding a little bit of what happened before the time that I knew them or the time that I knew you or whatever is quite interesting, because it starts to build, you know, Andy Van, exactly. You know, I'm probably going to call you that forever now. What are you most proud of? All the stuff you've done, all the different component parts that have got you to where you are today. What's the bit that you're most proud of?
A good question. There's a few things in my work life that I'm really proud of. So for my sins, I went and developed the bus cycle. So the test cycle that is now used for all the grants that we give for zero emission buses, they all have to go through this test cycle. And that was mid-90s. I went and sat on a London bus, Route 159 from Brixton Garage up to the top of Baker Street.
I know it well.
4:30 in the morning going out of Brixton Garage, the bus was full. I could not believe this. It was, you know, the old route master again. So that test cycle, again, this was part of London Transport Buses. They were they were at the leading edge of wanting a real world cycle. We all talk about real world and all this sort of real world WLTP. I've listened to some
That's
of the
not
previous.
Real world.
I'll come on to that later. But this bus cycle was, it was this very, very sort of, odd and transient, low speed, long Oxford Street, as I say. That developing that with a team around me. So, I was leading the team and even leading the team, and I do believe in going and sort of leading from the front, if you like. So I went and did the early shift and the late shift on the bus, and one of the guys came in and did the sort of day shift in between. So we spent the whole day on this bus data logging it, and it became the de facto standard used to this day. And from that, we went into the Green Bus Fund. So Zemo, a low CVP, helped develop all of the standards for low zero emission buses, low carbon emission buses, what is ultra low emission buses and zero emission buses now, on the back of that piece of work. So I would say I'm pretty proud of that. It's one of the one of my claims to fame, I would say. One of the other things probably that reflects the time at low CVP, and again this won't resonate too much with an EV cafe crew, but finally getting the introduction of E10 as a fuel. Which took us about 8 or 9 years to actually get through and bring. And in fact, getting a low carbon fuel into all the vehicles that are compatible with it, at the time, it had a bigger impact than all the electric vehicles that have been put on the road with all the grants behind them in terms of carbon saving, greenhouse gas saving. That was quite a long gestation period to get to that point. I've done a lot of work in fuels, and I'm a great believer in making whatever you've got as clean as it can be, whilst you then choose the next best thing when you're buying a new vehicle or upgrading your house, whatever it might be. Always try and go that step further with the cleanest and best technology next time. But whilst you're sat there, not everyone can afford to change everything around them. So what can we do to help them in the meantime? Cleaning up vehicles, driving them more efficiently, all those things are, a very valuable piece of the jigsaw.
Mm. Now, our listeners might be forgiven for thinking that you have lived a very charmed life. I mean, growing up, your parents kind of inspiring you into the Venture Scouts, into your career, which and of some things there to be hugely proud of, and I'm absolutely with you. Efficiency remains king even after we move to a zero tailpipe. Brakes, tires, there is still this drive to the true zero, right? But when is there a time in your life that you, as you reflect back on it, that you've had to dig really deep, where things haven't gone well and things have been challenging and you've had to, just kind of knuckle down and grin and bear it and get through? How have you, where's the time in your life that happened?
Yeah, I guess one of the things I used to do in my background at Millbrook was test all of the devices, all of these mad devices and magnets and all the things that people make claims about. Well, this will save you 30% of your fuel consumption. And I kind of took it upon myself to, let's take everything at face value, and what we'll do is test it properly. I had a few occasions with that where what I will call stupid and belligerent people just would not believe what you're doing. And they'd try to undermine everything about the way you do the test, you as a person, we can't trust you, that sort of stuff. And that, I would say, being questioned your integrity and your value, if you like, as what you've been brought up and what you've really cut your teeth on. And as, like I say, measurement technology was one of the things. So being questioned on that sort of thing by someone who just does not understand, to the extent where they've gone in and complained to managing directors about me, all that sort of stuff, that's pretty hard to take when you like I say, that's who you are. You're like I say, your integrity, you build yourself on the value of what you stand for and how you go about your job. And then someone who just is not prepared to work with you with that or accept what you're saying. And I think I listened to the back catalogue of Takeaway, and I think Stephen Williams was saying that facts You know, if he could change one thing in the world, can we get people to I think facts and versus myths is really one of the big problems. And myths do, you know, they really rile me. I was on a panel actually last week, and someone sent in on, you know, questions saying, oh, EVs are, you know, they're only 30% lower greenhouse gas on a life cycle basis than, you know, what? And it's like, well, no, they're not. The government data says they're at least 60% better on a grid. So I'm afraid I had to go straight in there and say, no, you're wrong. You know, the facts are this. The data says this, you know. So I would say it's that sort of, you know, that complete belligerence about not accepting the science, accepting the data, or, you know, looking at the different aspects. Like I say, every story has two sides, at least, as a minimum. And you need to look at both sides to fully understand what's going on. And this is where it comes back to that point about, you know, your perception of better. What is better? So better might be cheaper to one person. It might be lower carbon. It might be lower emissions. It might be faster. It might be smaller. It might be bigger. It might be lighter. So, you know, different people have different hot buttons. But as long as it's based on fact and not myth, I think I can support that.
So probably the last question for me, Andy, and it's one I get asked occasionally and I never know how to answer it. So it's fun actually being the one that's asking the question rather than trying to answer it. And that is to say, what advice would you give a teenage you?
Oh, crikey. Whatever.
Tough one, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. whatever it was you were going to do, don't do that, Andy, because that wasn't a good idea. Genuinely work with people you like and respect at whatever level. So whether you respect, you know, the people that lead you or you lead people that you respect, if you can do that, work doesn't feel as much like work. And I think that, you know, you can't choose your relatives. You can choose your friends and you can choose your work colleagues. So you spend a lot of time at work within your career. So try and work with people that you respect and respect them as well, and then you'll make great things happen, I would say.
So, you know, I think that's brilliant, because I think in the latter part of my career, I mean, I've worked with some great people, and I as I look back on my career, I've worked with a huge number of people that I really respect and really like. One or two that I didn't respect and didn't really like, but that is our working lives, isn't it? And I think I've always got the best out of me and also the people around me when, you know, I've been able to like and respect those people. And I think we, you know, one of the privileges we have as the EV Cafe is working as a team together. And, you know, as much as I take the mickey out of Sam in particular, I've got a huge amount of respect for him, and I like him.
And vice versa.
Yeah. but that is so important. But Andy, as you look back and as other people look back at Andy Eastlake in a few years' time, what will they say? How will people describe your life? What will be the things that stand out, do you think?
Again, a good question. I think hopefully they'll think that he stood for something. They might think, oh, who was he? I guess in many respects, I hope that they look back and they think, oh, Andy, wasn't he Ella and Hannah's father? And look at what they've done. Mm. And if I get to that point, yeah, I think that's a success.
That really resonates. Yeah, I look at my kids and think, yeah, I hope they do something, and I hope they think, oh, they're Paul's kids, aren't they? You know, and there's some stamp of me in them, and, you know, that sort of generational thing. Sam, you're looking philosophical.
No, I was just listening to you guys, and it's making me smile that my kids were Googling me on the Tesla screen this weekend, and they find it fascinating that they can put my name in and things pop up. But it's I guess it goes back to the legacy point, doesn't it? We're all wanting to leave a legacy and hopefully leave the planet in a better place than we found it, and our children are part of that, the recipients of that work, right? And so it's important that we keep that journey going, you know, to the next generation.
Absolutely. I think my younger daughter's actually going into motorsport, so she's got a placement with one of the Formula One teams. And you know, I spent all my time in road engines. My colleagues at university really went into motorsport, and all the time through that, you'll have heard this, you know, that motorsport sort of bleeds down into road and the technology develops, etc. Sustainability, we are now bleeding back across into motorsport. You know, yes. We're looking at the fuels. You know, electric vehicles are on the road before they were on the racetrack. And I think that is a really encouraging sort of trend, that the road is now taking back in and feeding back into leisure and sport and in that mode. And that, you know, so I see my daughter, as I say, having been brought up with electric cars around. I mean, I was driving electric cars in 2007, 2006, and probably off and on. There's one famous occasion where I borrowed a smart EV to pick my girls up from school. Of course, a smart EV only has one spare seat, so one of the girls walked half the way, and then they swapped over, and we drove back. So they've experienced EVs, the good, the bad, and the ugly, over those years. But now feeding back into motorsport, and how can we look at that being sustainable? That's really satisfying.
Yeah, you had me worried then, Andy, for a minute. I thought you were going to say you've been driving EVs longer than me, which would just ruin my intro for the rest of my life.
Well, I was hopeful then. I was like, oh, please say it's earlier.
Andy's the sort of person which I think statistically was probably going to knock me off my perch. So I'm quite delighted about that one. But yeah, just the point on the racing thing. I noticed that I was reading the other day about the development of engineering and technology into Formula One, and the fact that the drivetrain of the proportion of power attributed to the electric motors rather than the combustion engine is shifting from 20 or 30% to maybe 40 or 50, I think, going in the next few years, which is, again, an incredible sign. I wonder how that's going to impact on Formula E in the longer term. But I guess it's all for the right reasons. And it's interesting to see that, as you say, that sustainability agenda is coming from the bottom up in terms of pushing these highly emitting vehicles into a high performance but electric high performance solution instead. So it's nice to see that progression happening at a quicker rate than I was expecting it to, actually.
Yeah, I think they've still got their combustion engines, some of the most efficient combustion engines that you can make, but they're going to be putting sustainable fuel in there. They've got, you know, the impact of Formula One is actually all about the spectators and them traveling to the circuits. The amount of fuel they use on the racing is not a huge proportion, I don't think, but and then, you know, motorsport all the way down. You know, Formula One's the pinnacle of this huge industry that's got passions, you know, involved in it in terms of motorsport. And as I say, that the shift back into that, I think, is really encouraging. So whatever we can do, it's not something we as Zemo really get involved in, but, you know, motorsport, we're focused on road, and road is still the big area. You know, that's where the greenhouse gas problem lies. I think I've got a job for a few years yet dealing with that. But to see it bleed across some of the things that we've been doing, to bleed across into other areas, and we're seeing that into, you know, marine and aviation and other areas, it's really encouraging to see that progression and feel like you were part of something, you know, at the start of some of these things. So, more to do, but lots that I think we can lay claim to success already.
Well, Andy, it's really important that that people get to know the business that you've grown up in terms of Zemo partnership, I think, you know, we could have done this at the beginning, but give me the lift speech on Zemo partnership, and then tell us where we can find out more and how people can, because I know we you know, it's a not-for-profit organization, so people could support it and support your work. How can we interact with Zemo?
Yeah, so Zemo partnership, as you said, Paul, we're a part government funded, part membership funded, not-for-profit partnership, trying to accelerate the shift to zero emission vehicles. So that's what we're here to do. It's all about working together. You speak about collaborators. I think hopefully we embody that principle of collaboration and trying to work together. Sometimes that takes longer. You know, getting consensus can take longer than just charging off with your own view. But arguably, it's a more robust solution when you get there and you deliver it, whether it's into government or into consumers, as Sam and I have been working on for many years. Zemo.org.uk is the website. It's our 20th anniversary year. We were started in 2002, 2003, at a time when the automotive industry was going through a really radical change. It was in quite a difficult place. Carbon was just coming onto the frame, and it was about UK automotive industry trying to grapple with low carbon. I would say we're actually at almost an identical position now with UK automotive industry trying to grapple with electric vehicles. You know, the headlines that we see and the challenges that we're all part of, battery gigafactories, and, you know, so a really, really interesting time. And I would say more now than probably any time in that last 20 years, we need a Zemo there to help bring people together and try and, you know, work with all of these other complementary organizations. You know, we work closely with the APC, with the Cenexes of this world, the EST, some of those bodies, a lot of the trade bodies. You know, everybody's got a role to play, but the trick is bringing them together and trying to build consensus. And that might be on something as simple as the words we use for chargers that Sam and I are talking about, but it might be on, you know, what the policy around trucks should be, or buses, or how we take fuels to zero carbon fuels, you know, whether we indeed should use them on the road. So lots and lots to grapple with. But Zemo.org.uk, hopefully we'll be around for the next 20 years and still doing what we do. And in an ideal world, when we get to net zero, our job is done and I can pack up and retire into the sunset.
Well, Andy, I'm hoping that we all get an invite to the 20th anniversary party. I mean, there's got to be a party. And so, you know, where's my invite?
2 weeks' time, we've got our 20th anniversary conference at City Hall. I'll send you the invite personally, Paul, I promise. down at City Hall.
Do you know what? It's currently, what time is it? It's currently
9:33.
I can't see the clock. Thank you, Paul. 9:33 at 9:17 this morning during this podcast, I got an email: anniversary conference and celebration, Zemo 20. So already got it. Thank you very much.
I'll make sure yours gets to you, Paul. Personal invite.
Oh, fabulous. Thank you very much. Well, Andy, listen, it has been a pleasure. I mean, there's so many other things that I would love to talk to you about: autonomy, hydrogen, micromobility, the changing landscape. I mean, there's just so many things that I know that you're pretty much expert in. And if you don't know the facts, you know somebody that knows the facts. But it's been a privilege, as always, to talk with actually a real collaborator, person bringing together industry, working with so many parties across all of that for the greater good, not just to line your pocket, which is great news. But I'm sure you know you get paid enough. But listen, Andy Eastlake, thank you so much. Sam, great to have chatted with you as well and been involved in this. And listen, if you want to check out more chats, as Andy has already done, he's looked at our back catalogue, do please go and check out the evcafe.org website, as well as the zemo.org.uk website. I think, yes, I'm getting a nod from Andy. Excellent. So say goodbye, guys.
Yeah, thanks, Andy.
Bye, guys.
Bye for now.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you, Sam. Great to speak to you.
It's been our pleasure. Have a great day, everybody, and do keep checking us out on the EV Cafe Takeaway podcast.